You are listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto and CFBU 103.7 FM in St. Catharines. I'm your host, Erin O'Sullivan. Today's show is part two of Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About Vegan Nutrition But Were Afraid to Ask. Once again, we're here with vegan registered dietitian Jack Norris. He is going to answer a whole bunch of questions our listeners sent in, plus a few that have been bugging me. So first off, I am going to read a news article that I just came across, and it really does epitomize for me how infuriatingly complicated and often contradictory nutritional information can be. So you know antioxidants, those things that we've been vehemently advised to stuff ourselves silly with, lest the evil free radicals run rampage and destroy us from the inside out, right? Well, get a load of this article, which appeared in the UK newspaper The Guardian on January 13th of this year. The headline is, "The antioxidant myth is too easy to swallow. People are hooked on the fallacy that antioxidant is a byword for healthy. Perhaps the truth is less appealing." The article continues, "When the press release arrived in our inboxes, we knew what would happen next. A controversial Nobel laureate had stated in a peer-reviewed paper he described as, quote, among my most important work, unquote, that antioxidant supplements may have caused more cancers than they have prevented. Even the most fad-friendly sections of the UK media were bound to cover the story. In reality, Professor James Watson, one of the DNA double helix's founding fathers, was only restating what we at Cancer Research UK, along with many others, have been pointing out for years. Large studies have repeatedly shown that, with a possible exception of vitamin D, antioxidant supplements have negligible positive effect on healthy people, at least in terms of important things such as preventing getting cancer or dying prematurely, and some supplements, notably vitamins A, E, and beta carotene, even seem to slightly raise the risk of disease and early death." It's a topic we at Cancer Research UK come back to again and again on our science blog and on our social media pages. But as a quick trawl of Twitter reveals, huge swaths of the public remain convinced that antioxidant is a byword for healthy. What's so interesting about the antioxidant myth is its wider cultural and social dimension. Why is this perception so hard to shift, and is there anything we can do about it? One possible reason for our entrenched attitudes is the ubiquitous use of the word antioxidants in adverts proclaiming the health benefits of various food and drink. This isn't for want of regulation, and the Advertising Standards Authority have repeatedly upheld complaints about adverts that make unsupported claims about antioxidants' benefits. But the much weaker claim that a product merely contains high levels of antioxidants leaves health claims implicit and keeps regulators at bay. A brand of super broccoli launched with much fanfare in late 2011 was bred to contain high levels of a chemical that ultimately, according to the product's website, boosts our body's antioxidant enzyme levels. So the relentless drip-drip of health product advertising, particularly against a background of continual reports of Britain's ill health and our supposedly irresponsible behavior, makes our trenchant hold on the antioxidants myth all the more understandable. We need this stuff, we're told. But there's probably a deeper reason for our collective refusal to swallow the bitter pill of scientific evidence. The actual proven things that can reduce our risks of cancer, heart disease, diabetes, and all the other chronic nasties that come with an aging population are somewhat more prosaic. Don't smoke, stay in shape, eat a balanced diet, limit alcohol intake, keep active. This is hard work. As the resolution-filled new year kicks in, the exciting prospect of a healthier life is replaced by the realization that being healthy is a long-term project. Popping a pill instead of going to the gym is a tempting prospect for many of us. But the UK population is aging and likely to place a greater burden on the NHS in future. We owe it to ourselves and those who will be paying for our care to make sure we're as healthy as possible for as long as possible. Putting our faith in a word and a pill, however comforting it may sound, to do this for us is a mirage and a fallacy. Antioxidants do not prolong our lives nor prevent cancer, despite what we want to believe. As Professor Watson remarked in his paper, blueberries best be eaten because they taste good, not because their consumption will lead to less cancer. So I think that I am going to cry. Really, I cannot take it anymore. Do you have any idea how much money I have spent on blueberries over the years because I thought they were supposed to make me healthy? And I don't even like the nasty little things. Next time I go past a farmer's market, I think I'm going to imagine I hear them laughing at me with their little high-pitched blueberry voices. But anyway, that is why it's so important that we have honest, non-gimmicky, vegan-centric nutritionists like Jack Norris around to help us navigate this wretched informational quagmire. Now, before we get started asking Jack this week's round of questions, let's have a little recap of the last show. Now, Jack was one of the founders of Vegan Outreach, along with Matt Ball, who we also just interviewed, and Jack became a registered dietitian largely so he could offer advice to the vegans and potential vegans that he would meet through his vegan advocacy work. You can get more info on Vegan Outreach at veganoutreach.org and more about Jack's dietitian work at jacknorrisrd.com and at veganhealth.org. So some of the stuff we covered last time. The blood type diet is apparently a big thumbs down. B12 deficiency is a pretty big deal, so make sure you are getting some. If you don't have many fortified foods, for example, fortified soy milk in your diet, you best take a supplement just to be safe. You can't really alkalize yourself, only your pee, so don't bother trying. When it comes to protein, the star of the amino acid show for vegans is lysine, which you can find aplenty in legumes. Remember, L is for legumes, L is for lysine. Eat 'em, people. So that's my short layperson's recap of all the sciencey goodness Jack shared with us last time. I strongly encourage everybody to check out that show. It's online now at animalvoices.ca, ready for instant listening. How about that? You don't even have to download the shows anymore. You just go to the site, press the button, and it is vegan gravy. Now on with today's show. Jack, welcome back to Animal Voices.
Thanks, Erin. I'm glad to be back.
Well, let's dive right in, shall we? So question one is about essential fatty acid supplements. And now I know that we talked about different kinds of fats on the last show, but this is kind of a different question. It relates to those bottles of oils that you buy to take as supplements rather than, say, to put in food. So the common one, I think, is Udo's oil blend. Now, a lot of people that I know swear that these oil blends noticeably improve their cognition, alertness, and overall mental functioning, such that they actually notice the difference on a day-to-day basis. So if they miss a dose, they might feel fuzzy-headed or something like that. Now, I thought this sounded kind of far-fetched, though I do admit that I ran out and bought a bottle after seeing one really enthusiastic Facebook exchange that convinced me that I was like losing IQ points every second and my brain was not properly lubricated with Udo's oil. But of course, I forgot to take it and that was the end of that. So I don't know. So the question is there any scientific basis for the perceived effects of these oil supplements?
Okay. It does not sound likely to me that there's anything in omega-3 fatty acids that could cause an immediate benefit or make someone feel better immediately. I haven't seen any research showing how people respond immediately after eating them or the next day or the next couple days or even a week. In fact, there's very little information about how people feel in general after supplementing with omega-3s or other oils. Just basically, they measure different blood parameters generally. So, you know, I can't say for sure that this isn't happening to some people, but it doesn't sound likely to me.
But I guess in these cases, one might say, well, even if it's a placebo, I guess if it makes you feel better, then it's not really hurting you, maybe.
Right.
Although maybe taking big tablespoons of oil isn't good for you in other ways, right?
Oh, that's true. I mean, I don't know how much they take or how much Udo recommends of their oils.
I think you're supposed to take like a teaspoon twice a day or something like that.
Well, that's probably not a big deal. Unless you're adding it, supplementing it with lots of other oils. But certainly 2 teaspoons of oil a day for your total oil intake is not a problem for most people.
Right, but that could be coating a delicious donut or something like that. So consider that you're wasting calories, right?
That's true. I mean, I don't take Udo's oils myself. I don't see any reason to do it.
Okay, next question. I often hear people denounce vegan diets because they say that the human body doesn't absorb supplements or vegan forms of key nutrients, like, say, calcium, from vegetable sources as well as they do from animal sources. Like they say, if you're not getting the calcium from milk, you're not absorbing it the same. So is there anything to that, this idea that you're not absorbing?
No, there's not much to that. Supplements are generally absorbed adequately well. Almost no nutrient that you eat is going to be absorbed at 100%, with maybe the exception of calories, protein, carbohydrates, and fat, though even in that case, some of them might not be absorbed, but it would be a small percentage. Now, if we can look at a few of the different minerals, vitamin B12 is particularly well absorbed from supplements. It's absorbed better from supplements than animal foods because it comes attached to protein in animal foods that your stomach acid has to cleave from, your stomach acid and digestive enzymes. I'm not sure exactly which part does all the cleaving, but it has to be separated from the animal protein. And for this reason, the Institute of Medicine recommends that people over 50 get at least half the RDA from fortified foods or supplements, half their B12 RDA from them, because the B12 in supplement form is crystalline B12 and it just comes on its own. It's not attached to anything. So that's B12. Calcium, you can absorb calcium about the same from milk, soy milk, bok choy, turnip greens, mustard greens, collard greens, broccoli, and kale. Some of them are higher than milk, and some are slightly lower. But it's all around 30 to 40%, with one study showing some of the greens to be even higher than that. Now, the thing is that the greens don't have nearly as much calcium as milk does. And for most nutrients, the more you eat at once, the lower the percentage of absorption is going to be, because your body just isn't going to absorb it all. And once you fill up the mechanism for absorption, then it starts to shut off quickly. Water-soluble B vitamins are somewhat of an exception to that, where your body can absorb large amounts of them and then you urinate them out for the most part. Calcium in spinach, Swiss chard, and beet greens is not well absorbed because of the oxalates and those foods that bind with the calcium, and then you excrete the oxalate calcium compound. Iron is a tricky one. If someone doesn't absorb iron well, you might have to supplement with a lot of iron to make much of a difference. But vitamin C, which I might have mentioned in the last talk, I'm not sure, but vitamin C increases iron absorption quite a bit if it's eaten at the same time as the food with iron, whereas tea and coffee decreases iron absorption. And where supplements fall, supplements are probably slightly better absorbed than food iron, unless the food iron is mixed with vitamin C. But you can also mix the supplement with vitamin C as well. In fact, some iron supplements come with ascorbic acid, which is vitamin C. So I think that's about, I probably answered your question and much more, but if you have anything more.
Well, I think that what I'm getting from it is that there's something to be said for this idea that not all vitamins are created equal. But at the end of the day, it sounds like you're saying if you're taking a supplement, you're getting what you need. So there's no worry that, well, it's not this.
Well, I mean, it's not quite that simple, but some people say that you just can't absorb vitamins and minerals from supplements, and that's not true. In most cases, you absorb them as well or better than from food. So that's what I'm saying. But it doesn't mean that you're necessarily getting all you need. You can't just take a multivitamin and assume you're getting all your vitamins and minerals from it. No, it doesn't work quite that easily.
So the next question is about fasting. Now, I fasted once, and that ended after about 3 days with me with my head in a toilet vomiting battery acid. Though in fairness, instead of
Wow.
drinking plenty of water like the fasting gurus advise, I actually drank coffee because I had to work and I had to keep myself awake. So that might have been the problem. So I'm still very open-minded to the notion that fasting can be good for you. So that's our listener's question. Is there any health benefit to fasting?
Well, I don't think fasting's been studied a whole lot, and I'm actually also not real familiar with all the research on fasting, but I do know of some of the research, and some has indicated that people who are overweight, particularly for them, intermittent fasting, which is maybe one day at a time or so, the fasting can increase glucose tolerance, reduce inflammation, and decrease asthma.
Is increasing glucose tolerance good or bad?
Good. Yeah, that's a tricky term, actually. It means your body can use glucose more effectively, because what happens is that a lot of people are constantly flooding their cells with glucose from eating too much, and then the cells become resistant to using it. And then when you take away the glucose for, longer than normal, then the cells start to become better at using it again. How this works out long term and what someone should do, I mean, I don't think anyone knows, but you would want to talk to a doctor if you were going to try to do fasting for any sort of medical therapy for yourself. I also know that, I guess it was a study in veterans, or at least this was done in veterans, where they were fasted to get their bodies to start putting on weight, because some, they were emaciated. It may have been from being in prisoner of war camps or something like that, and they couldn't get them to put on weight until they started fasting them a bit. And I guess your body can kick in the mechanism to start storing food if you're fasted. And like I said, I don't know all the details about that either. So then there was another study where 13 days of fasting reduced blood pressure. That's a lot of fasting. And I think that there might be better ways to reduce your blood pressure. And I'm not surprised by that at all.
Yeah, that's probably just because you're not moving.
Well, you're losing weight and other things. But if you've got critically high blood pressure, it may kill you. And of course, talk to a doctor first, but maybe that's one way to deal with it. And I was also, we learned in RD school that after 48 hours of not eating, your intestinal villi, which are the outer layer of your intestinal cells have lots and lots of kind of like fingers pointing out from the cell, so that they have a lot of contact with the contents of your intestines and they can absorb nutrients better. So if you don't use them, then they start to deteriorate and you no longer have these fingers extruding into your intestines and you can't absorb things as well. And this can be a problem for people who can't eat, and that's why we learned a decent amount about it. And then you have to start feeding people slowly to allow their intestinal villi to start to build back. So some people fast to give their digestive system a break, and I don't think there's much science behind that as being beneficial. But like I said, for these other things, the small amounts of research that have been done have shown them to be have some therapeutic value.
But there's no real evidence either that it's bad for you, because I guess that would be the concern. It's like, well, even if it's not good for you, figure if it makes people happy, go ahead and do it. But there's not any evidence that it can perhaps make you sick. Except, well, you kind of suggested that maybe there is if you're losing your ability to absorb nutrients.
Well, you definitely have to be careful when you start eating again if you have not eaten for a number of days. If you eat too fast, you're going to feel pretty sick. But of course, I mean, it depends how long you go. People die of fasting, but you have to go for many weeks to do that, for the most part. I mean, if someone isn't in good health, they could die maybe much quicker than that. You just need to be careful, and I don't think it's been studied well enough to know about all the long-term harm or benefits. Though you can definitely take fasting to an extreme and die from it.
Next question is there a link between eating disorders and veganism? And the general public certainly seems to think so. And I actually understand that certain eating disorder treatment programs won't actually let patients follow vegan diets because of this perceived link.
Well, there have been a lot of studies. Well, they're all almost all cross-sectional studies done looking at disordered eating and vegetarianism and veganism. And what they've started to tease out some of the results in a better way more recently, and they found that most of the evidence shows there's actually a reverse link between being a vegan and having disordered eating patterns. However, there does seem to be a higher risk of disordered eating among semi-vegetarians, and those are people who eat meat occasionally. Less than once a week is the definition usually of semi-vegetarian, but more than once a month. And that could be because those people are using vegetarianism to try to lose weight. I mean, there's a what came first issue going on with disordered eating and vegetarianism. And they found that people who become vegan for ethical reasons and not to lose weight, they do not have a higher risk of getting an eating disorder. That's what the research has shown so far. And I have a number of blog posts on my website if you want details of what the study showed. You can just go to jacknorrisrd.com and there's a category for eating disorders.
Oh, so at least it's not my imagination that there's certainly the perception out there that there's a link.
No, because early studies did associate vegetarian diets with eating disorders. But it was a question of, well, was it because these people first had an eating disorder and then decided to become vegetarian to. It's a way for some people to cut out a lot of food groups out of their diet in a justifiable way. You know what I mean? It's easier to tell someone I'm not eating this because I'm vegetarian than just I'm not eating this because I have disordered eating.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be awkward.
Yes.
Okay, so the next question is, describe what you would consider to be an ideal diet. Like, provide maybe a day's perfect menu from a, I guess maybe from a purely nutritional perspective, say if taste and expense were not issues.
Okay, so I'm about to tell every person exactly how they should eat every day. No, I'm kidding. It really depends on the person and their needs, obviously. And there's a wide range of how to eat. And if someone has, say, has metabolic syndrome, or they have heart disease or type 2 diabetes, or inclined towards those diseases, I would recommend eating much different than, say, a triathlete who needs 5,000 calories a day. You know, it can depend on someone's ability to digest fiber and different types of fiber, food allergies, all sorts of things, whether someone is glucose intolerant or not. In Vegan for Life, the book I wrote with Jenny Messina, who is another vegan RD, we lay out menu plans, but it would take me too much time to go over them in any detail.
Probably the most common vegan example of a approach to eating that I can think of is the low-fat vegan diet that's promoted by a lot of the high-profile people in the vegan nutrition world. So, this low-fat vegan diet, is that the final answer?
No, I don't think that's the final answer. Now, compared to a standard American diet, if you have heart disease or type 2 diabetes, then a low-fat vegan diet is probably going to improve a number of your parameters, and especially your cholesterol levels, but also a low-fat vegan diet of whole foods will probably allow you to lose weight as well. And that, you know, if you lose weight, then your insulin resistance will go down. But in terms of whether a low-fat vegan diet is the optimal diet for everyone, I think there's plenty of evidence that that's not the case, and it's certainly not been proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that that is the best diet for everyone. So in terms of cholesterol levels, low saturated fat is probably the biggest thing, and you can eat low saturated fat without eating a fat-free diet, or at least a no added fat diet. And there was a study done, and it was only 4 weeks, so it's not, you know, you can't do a whole lot with a study of only 4 weeks when you're looking at this sort of thing. But they put people on an Eco-Atkins diet, they called it, where it was a vegan diet but with low carb and higher fat and
What
protein.
did people eat? Avocados? Avocados and tofu?
They ate a lot of processed meats, actually. Off the top of my head, I don't remember exactly all they ate. I do have a blog post on it. In any case, they ate a high fat, high protein, low carb diet, and their blood cholesterol improved quite a bit. And they found that it was a more satisfying diet than a lower fat, higher carb diet. Now, I don't think that that is the end all study to show that it's better not to eat a very low fat diet. That's just one data point. But another one is that if you look at the average fat intake of vegans compared to meat eaters, say in Epic Oxford, which is one of the biggest studies done that has measured dietary intake of vegans, the percentage of fat for the vegans in that study was 30%, and it was compared to 34% in the meat eaters. Yet the vegans' average cholesterol was 158 compared to 191 for the meat eaters. And that is, to a large extent, the difference was saturated fat, which the vegans had 5% saturated fat, whereas the meat eaters had 12%. But the vegans also had quite a lower amount of calories. It was 500 calories per day less in the vegans, 28 grams of fiber in the vegans versus 18 in the meat eaters. And then the vegans, of course, had no dietary cholesterol. So the vegans ended up with much lower cholesterol levels. So it shows that you can have low cholesterol levels and you can still have a 30% fat diet. I think the key is probably calories. Well, I mean, it's not exactly clear, but if you're taking in too many calories, your body stores it, the extra calories is fat. And so it's like eating a lot of fat, whether you are or not. Not every aspect. I mean, there's some parts of it. You're not necessarily bringing the fat right into your digestive tract immediately, like if you're eating it, but you do end up with a lot of fat. And weight gain has been linked to increased cholesterol levels, so that's one aspect. So I think one argument in favor of very low fat diets is that it's harder to eat too many calories, for some people at least. A tablespoon of oil contains quite a few calories, whereas a tablespoon of some other food is not going to have nearly as many. If you soak your food in oil, you can eat a tremendous amount of calories all at once. So just avoiding all oil, that's going to make it a lot harder to eat as many calories. Now, some people don't find oil-free diets very satisfying, and they may end up just eating a lot of food just to make up for the fact that they're not satisfied. And fat has been shown to increase satiety. So what some people recommend is you start off a meal with some fat because it slows stomach emptying. So it slows down your digestion, so you fill up faster than if you don't eat fat at the beginning of a meal. So there's a lot of different variables, and it's not clear what is the best way to eat, in my opinion, at this time.
We have to pause for a brief station identification, but before we do, I am going to play a song for you by an Ottawa band called Old Stereo. This song is called Made Up, and it is off the album Crossed the Line. The vegan guitarist from the band says that the song reminds him of when he made up his mind to go vegan. So again, this is Made Up off the album Crossed the Line, which is available for download on iTunes. Welcome back to Animal Voices. We're here with vegan registered dietitian Jack Norris for part two of the show, Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About Vegan Nutrition But Were Afraid to Ask. You mentioned a couple of minutes ago that one of the determinants of what sort of diet you should eat depends on, for example, your ability to digest fiber. I've always understood that you absolutely need fiber and you have to eat it, even if it gives you terrible stomach pains. So, is that not true? If people are experiencing terrible stomach pain, should they just say to hell with the fiber and stop eating it?
Well, they should cut back on it and see if their pain goes away. I mean, I think that that's one of the issues with the vegan diet, why some people have a hard time with it, because some people just aren't used to so much fiber. But a vegan diet can range in fiber from anywhere from, 20 to 60 or even 80 grams of fiber a day. It really depends on what you decide to eat. Someone could eat a whole lot of greens, and then someone else is just not going to be able to digest a whole lot of greens. So it'd be ideal for everyone to be able to eit a whole lot of greens, at least low oxalate greens. But if you can't digest them, then you can't digest them. And no, I don't think you should force yourself through intense stomach pains to be eating high amounts of fiber. Other fiber might be fine. Like greens are going to have cellulose, but then apple and oatmeal are going to have more soluble fiber, and that might be just fine for your stomach. So it just kind of depends on the fiber too.
Interesting. So stop torturing yourselves, guys. If it gives you a stomach ache, don't eat it.
I haven't heard anyone actually torture themselves like that, but that's interesting to hear that maybe people are. Have you had stomach pains from fiber, do you think?
I think talking about my digestive woes would be a bit too much of a TMI for my listeners.
All
Let's
right.
say I've heard other people talking about their problems with fiber. So anyway, moving right along. There's a lot of talk online and in the newspaper about superfoods. So are there any vegan superfoods? Like, what are the top five foods that you would say vegans should eat?
The top five foods. All right. So one is yellow vegetables, and I think a really good one is sweet potatoes. But carrots are another good one because they're high in beta carotene, which we need for vitamin A. And the one thing about vitamin A, though, and oil, since we were talking about that, is that it's fat soluble, and to absorb it well, you probably need to add some fat to it. So what I like to do is put a little bit of non-trans fat margarine on sweet potatoes to make sure I'm absorbing it. But carrots would work just as well. Sweet potatoes are pretty tasty. Now let's see what else. Of course, beans or legume products, I think we should be eating plenty of because they're so high in protein. And if you don't eat them, then you may be short on lysine, as you had mentioned at the beginning. Walnuts are a great food. They're high in good fats. They have some omega-3 fats. And nuts are just associated across the board with all kinds of reduction in heart disease markers.
Can I intercede here for a second?
Sure.
Because a friend of mine actually asked this question a while back in a different context, but they were worried that they were eating too many nuts because they eat a lot of smoothies and they grind up maybe like a cup of nuts. So they wind up eating a cup of nuts a day. Is that too much?
Well, I don't. If they're not gaining weight, then the only other issue that I can think of would be possible nutrient absorption issues, but I doubt that there's anything to worry about. I mean, nuts are very high in nutrients, but they also have phytates that can bind some. I don't think I would worry about it. Nuts are generally pretty good. Let's see. Tomato sauce is very high in potassium, and as vegans, we generally should be getting a lot of potassium, but I don't know that all of us are. Potassium is really good to get.
What about the master banana? I thought that was the king of potassium.
That's really, I mean, it is a decent source of potassium, but there's many, many foods that are higher, and tomato sauce is much, much higher.
And you say tomato sauce specifically, so does this harken back to our earlier conversation about you have to cook it?
Yeah, I think you have to cook it. You have to get the water off so that the tomatoes are condensed, the sauce is condensed. Otherwise, it's going to be too much of a
Oh,
volume.
okay.
Unless you have a way to separate the water from the rest of the tomato without cooking it. But generally, you cook it and it steams off. All right. Okay, so you asked about the top five foods vegans should not eat. Well, you shouldn't drink coffee and tea with meals. And I think it's fine to drink it at other times, but it can prevent iron absorption. And then French fries can be high in trans fats, and they're usually made from white potatoes. And white potatoes have a very high glycemic index and a high glycemic load. It's basically like drinking soda, except without the fructose. Just has glucose. But you're going to get a lot of sugar really fast. I would say, of all the vegan foods I can think of that are not, ridiculously unhealthy, like large amounts of candy, French fries are probably the worst. But that doesn't mean I never eat them either. I don't eat them often, but somewhat.
All right, so is that the end of the bad vegan foods?
Yes.
All right. So my next question is about, and I noticed that you didn't highlight soy in your top five foods. And the specific question that I wanted to ask you was as follows. I have heard that soy milk and other soy products can affect sexual development and sexual orientation, but I've heard the same thing about hormones in cow's milk. Is there any truth to either of those claims?
Okay, so any reasonable amount of soy cannot affect sexual development. And in fact, one study that tracked kids who were fed soy formula tracked them into adulthood and found no sexual development problems. And soy formula is a lot of soy compared to what your average adult vegan would be eating. Now, there have been two cases where an adult male vegan was eating over 10 servings of soy per day. And they did develop some strange things that went away upon ceasing the soy, but this was very unusual, and it was, like I said, over 10 servings per day.
But the thing is, servings are pretty small, really, aren't they? Like, how many servings of soy would you say would be in a block of tofu?
I usually think of a serving of tofu as 3 ounces or a half a cup. So a block would be maybe four. Is
Yeah,
that
four or
right?
five or something like that. But yeah, like, I don't know. I
Yeah.
can see somebody being able to go through 2 blocks of tofu in a day.
Yeah, well, it doesn't happen to most people. These were rare cases, so I don't
Okay.
know.
So it's not that, 10 servings of soy equals whatever happened to these guys.
Well, say you were doing soy milk, you'd have to drink 10 glasses of soy milk, 8 ounce glasses.
Yeah.
So
Which I could probably do. That's kind of scary, but well, I'd probably feel sick,
that could be
but
your next fast to
yeah,
see how much soy
exactly.
milk you could drink each day.
Yes,
But
exactly.
I'm hold on, I'm not I am not done yet.
Okay.
So the hormones in cow's milk, a 2010 study showed that kids in the highest one-third of animal product intake had an earlier onset of puberty by about 7 months. And there are other studies that back that study up, including one that was just about dairy. So there does seem to be some evidence that the animal products and probably cow's milk does affect the onset of puberty. I mean, 7 months is nothing like years, but it may be enough to actually affect certain cancer rates. So it is a concern. Researchers that did that study anyway seemed like they thought they had found something to be concerned about.
So soy milk for the win on the hormone thing. All
Yeah, I
right.
think so. On that case.
Okay, so next question. I think we've sort of peripherally addressed this in many of the other questions, but I think, having a direct answer would be helpful anyway. Will adopting a vegan diet really make you lose weight?
Okay. It depends, obviously, again, on the vegan diet and the person. And I've known people who've gone vegan and lost a tremendous amount of weight. And sometimes it was over the course of the first year. And I'm talking 60 pounds, maybe closer to 100 for one person I'm thinking of. But I know other people who have gained weight on a vegan diet. Now, the research shows that in general, vegans gain less weight over time than people in other diet groups. So it's generally the case that vegans are going to have an easier time with weight gain. And I guess that's because almost everyone does gain weight throughout their adult life, at least through middle age. But it really depends. I mean, generally, if you're eating less calories, you're going to lose weight. And vegan diets do tend to promote less calories.
Right. So we can say, there's variability. It's not going to be a magic bullet for everybody. But on the other hand, your own observations have shown that it's not a load of crap either. This idea that, wow, this person went on, because that's you see these late night diet pill shows and they say, oh my God, I lost like 700 pounds on, and I didn't do any exercise. But what you're saying is that these significant weight drops do happen on a vegan diet and you've observed them. So.
They have happened for some people, and I've seen it with mine own eyes. But how common that is, I don't really know. And there are studies like the PCRM studies on diabetes where people go on whole foods vegan diets and they drop, I'd have to look to see exactly, but they drop a dozen pounds or so. And I, you know, those studies have been done. I think one looked at people for 72 months. So it was a long-term study, and they kept the weight off to some extent. Usually there's a big drop at first, and then people start to gain, creep back. And that could be because they don't stick with the diet or because their body adapts. And remember the last conversation we had, I talked about the genetic differences between people, and some people lose weight easier on a high-carb diet. And then other people lose weight easier on a low carb diet. So that could explain some of the differences with some of these people as well.
The next question is, what in the name of God is going on with gluten? It seems like half of the vegans I know are suddenly gluten-free now, and half of them have switched from veganism to vegetarianism because so much gluten-free stuff has egg as a binder to replace the gluten. And since gluten is a major ingredient in a lot of vegan mock meats and is therefore a major source of protein for a lot of vegans, this seems to me like a pretty big deal. So the question is the whole gluten-free phenomenon a fad, or is gluten really truly bad for you?
It depends on who you are. Obviously, people who have celiac disease need to avoid gluten, and that's a fairly intense reaction to gluten. Well, there's a theory that people with two alleles, which is a genetic term, people with two alleles for celiac have a very strong version, and then if you just have one, you might have a mild version of celiac. And I've heard other explanations by researchers that say you either have celiac or you don't. So there's some controversy there. It's kind of strange because the people with bad celiac, their symptoms are very, very strong. And it's supposed to be kind of an all or nothing thing where you have an autoimmune reaction and you either get it or you don't. But there may be that people do get mild forms of it. And then other people have gluten intolerance, which isn't celiac. It's not an autoimmune reaction, but they have very similar symptoms with digestive problems, inflammation, fatigue, joint pain. So if you get these things from eating gluten or you suspect it, then I would definitely go off gluten for a few weeks and then see if your symptoms clear up. And if they do and you want to pursue it any further, you could try to add back a little bit of gluten and see if they come back. But the amount of people with diagnosed celiac disease is a very small percentage of the population. It's about 1%. Now, that doesn't include the people with gluten intolerance, but combining both celiac and gluten intolerance and even mild cases of celiac, assuming that this is a significant phenomena, it must be less than 5% of people. So hopefully that is the case and that the other 95% don't have to worry about gluten.
So what I'm getting from your answer, the known prevalence of gluten intolerance in any form, whether it be celiac, bad celiac, or celiac, this sort of minor celiac that might exist, or even gluten intolerance, is it's probably a fairly low percentage of the population that's got it. So maybe gluten intolerance has really sort of come to the fore right now, but as more and more people maybe do an elimination diet and realize they don't have it, this gluten-free trend might go away.
Well, it's been around for decades, so I don't know if it's ever going to go away. But some people that are anti-gluten may argue that you might not know that you have issues with gluten, and so who knows where the arguments are going to lead. But I generally think that if you don't suffer from eating gluten in any way, then there's no reason to think that you need to cut gluten out. At this time, there's certainly no reputable scientific reason to cut gluten out unless you have one of these problems.
So I was actually starting to wonder if it was like part of the meat industrial complex, because first they went after soy with the hormone stuff, and now they're going after seitan with the gluten-free stuff, you know? So maybe I'm paranoid, but think about it, everybody. Anyway, that's my theory. Next question. I keep hearing vegans say that after they were off meat for a year or so, saying that when they ate meat by accident, it made them violently ill. Is that possible? And I guess the kernel of the question is, can people lose the ability to digest meat?
I don't think you can lose the ability to digest meat because there's no special enzymes that digest meat that you would stop producing. There's not like, say, with milk, there's a lactase enzyme that can prevent you from digesting lactose. So in that case, I don't think you lose the ability to digest it, but you may lose the ability to ward off an allergy to meat. That's one thing that I have a suspicion about. I had a biology professor when I was in college who claimed that he didn't eat meat for a while, I think it was about a year. And then he ate it and broke into these terrible hives and had to go to the hospital and stuff. And so he decided that he had to always eat meat to keep his immune system up and fighting so that if he ever had to eat meat, absolutely, he wouldn't end up with these hives. Now,
What awesome backwards logic, eh? It's like this food made me break out in hives, so I have to eat it every single
that is
day.
interesting
That's great.
thing about it, but his theory was someday he may be, on a stranded desert island and all of
The
nothing to eat but
proverbial
meat. And so
chicken.
what if, I don't know if he just thought maybe I'll be at a party some, maybe I'll be at a party sometime and I'll be hungry or I don't know. But in any case, and it's just an anecdotal report. I mean, it's not even necessarily that it was a meat. Maybe he ate a particularly bad form of meat, or maybe it was salmonella. Who knows? So I guess the main thing is I wouldn't completely dismiss the fact that people say they eat meat and get sick, but not being able to digest it, losing the ability to digest meat, I'm not aware of evidence that that happens.
Okay, the next question. The American Dietetic Association has affirmed that a well-planned vegan diet is safe for children. But are there any real go-to foods that you would recommend that vegan kids get lots of?
I think tofu is a pretty good food for kids, especially younger ones, infants, as they're learning to eat. It's high in protein and calories, it's low in fiber, and it doesn't have any strong taste. And it seems to be well liked by a lot of the kids that I've known. And I just wanted to say that there is a page on veganhelp.org that has a list of real vegan children, children who have been, their mothers were vegan at conception, and they've been vegan their whole lives. And so you can check out that anecdotally, a lot of kids are doing well on a vegan diet. There isn't much research on vegan kids. It's very little and disappointingly little. Mostly anecdotal reports is what we have to go on at this point. That's not completely what we have to go on, but the body of research is small.
What about peanut butter? Because peanuts aren't nuts, right? They're legumes. So they probably have a lot of the lysine. So I just know that there's certain things that kids like, and one of them seems to be peanut butter. So is that something that would be a really good thing for vegan kids to eat a lot of?
Sure. I mean, once they're old enough to be able to swallow it safely,
Right.
yes.
Or not, make all their friends explode with shock, anaphylactic
Anaphylactic
shock.
shock, right? Yeah, you got to make sure they're not allergic to them.
Yeah, that's a problem. You can't bring peanut butter into a lot of schools, but I guess when they're at home.
Yeah.
Okay, I actually skipped over this question by accident. The question of what's the deal with food combining? Why do people do it? And what are they combining? And is there any scientific basis for it?
Yeah, so that's what I was referring to this earlier when we were talking about the best way for people to eat, because I was going to say that I actually recommend the exact opposite of food combining, but let me first explain it. The idea is that you can only digest fat, protein, or carbohydrates at one time, and so it's best to just keep your meals separate. Very difficult to do because most foods have at least two of those components, though fruit might be the exception that's very low in protein and fat. Many fruits are. So they mainly say, don't ever mix fruit with anything else. And, I don't remember what all the rules are, but they have complicated charts of how to do it. And there's basically no scientific evidence that this is of any benefit at all. And the biggest organization that promoted this theory throughout the last century, the American Natural Hygiene Society, I think is what it was called, or maybe just the Natural Hygiene Society. They changed their mind on this sometime around 2000 and sent out a statement, an official statement, saying that there's no scientific evidence that the theory behind food combining, that you can't digest multiple macronutrients, which are fat, protein, and carbs, at the same time, is not true.
That's awesome because it sounds like if you ate like the exact proportion of all three, then you could eat forever and never gain any weight, you know? Like if you balance them all anyway.
Well, I do think that mixing all three at meals creates the most satisfying meal. So I tend to think that you should mix all three.
Here's a kind of a related question. You know when you hear things about like people's protein window and how you're supposed to eat carbs at a certain time of day or do something after you work out or before you work out or while you're working out? Is there
Yep.
anything to that?
I think some research has shown that if you eat protein right after a workout, you'd build more muscle. And I'm not an expert on that research at all, but I've read about it. Of course, there's all kinds of exercise nutrition where if you're doing a triathlon or something, there's how much sugar you should eat per 45-minute increment and that sort of thing, and what to do before the event. But if you're not talking about athletic events, then, I don't think that there's any sort of people are better off eating protein between 10 and a.m. and 2 p.m. or something like that. I've not seen any evidence that that is the case.
All right, so we're just about at the end of the interview, so I'm going to ask the last question, and it sort of harkens back to what you were just saying about not being much evidence of this, that, or the other thing. And the question is, so how much do we really know about vegan nutrition? We keep talking about there being a little bit of evidence of this or no evidence of that, but does it mean that there's actually evidence against it, or just that there's not really been much research one way or the other? And I liken this to a lot of natural medicines. They're always sort of dissed because there's no scientific support for them, or they've never been scientifically proven, but it's more because they've never been studied really than that their effectiveness has ever actually been disproven.
Yeah, well, in that particular case, I think there's legitimacy in saying that if a medicine has not been studied with a randomized controlled trial and shown to be effective, that there's no evidence that it is. Because how else would someone know if it's effective and just not a placebo effect that they've observed in people? But aside from that, in terms of nutrition, you actually asked me in the email, how well do we understand human nutrition? And that's a little bit different than vegan nutrition. So I was going to just talk a tiny bit about that. There is a lot of evidence for some theories. The idea that saturated fat increases cholesterol, which leads to heart disease, I'd say that's a pretty good bet. I mean, we know a lot about that, and it's been studied very thoroughly. There's details to work out, but we're pretty safe on that one. Some people come along and say that that's just complete bunk, and not from what I can tell. There's a great body of research that backs that up. There's another body of research that shows that obesity leads to type 2 diabetes, and that seems also to be pretty rock solid. And then the corollary of that is that controlling blood sugar reduces the side effects of type 2 diabetes. That also seems to be well established. And there's a few other things like, reducing hypertension. There's diets that are consistently can do that. I think in terms of nutrition and cancer, there's a great deal of questions about that. There's a few cancers that seem fairly good evidence, say that high sodium diets can increase stomach cancer. That seems to be well established. But in terms of how much fruit and how much vegetables and what they do, how much they can prevent cancer, how much food actually does have to do with cancer prevention, in general, those are very open questions. It's not at all like smoking and cancer, where smoking and cancer is quite well established.
So, we know a fair bit in terms of heart disease. We know a fair bit in terms of the effect of diet on diabetes, not so much about cancer. And just in terms of general healthfulness, is a lot of stuff pretty much hearsay, like when you talk about low carb versus, I don't know, I saw a show the other day about a guy that eats nothing but spoiled meat. He claims it saved his life. So, in terms of general healthfulness, do we not know too much?
The idea that eating spoiled meat will save your life is very well established. No, I'm kidding. It really depends on the thing. there's a wide range of evidence for various ideas. I mean, there's so many ideas in nutrition, you know, like the whole debate about how much calcium do you need to prevent osteoporosis and how much vitamin D. A lot of these things, even some of them have been very well studied, and we don't really know the answers yet. But on the extremes, we do know. We know if someone, say, especially Caucasian women, if they get 100 milligrams of calcium a day their whole lives, they're probably setting themselves up for some pretty severe osteoporosis. Now, that's a lot different than if someone gets 700 milligrams a day their whole life, which is much closer to the RDA. They might be just fine. And I'm talking on average because there's always individual differences. We can never say for sure this is going to happen to you.
Okay, well, we are just about at the end of the interview. I just wanted to remind the audience that if they want more information on vegan nutrition, they can go to jacknorrisrd.com. But before we go, I just wanted to say, Jack, you have a lot of articles on your website. Are there any that you would say this is really essential reading for vegans?
Well, in terms of their health or in terms of their activism, those are two different questions. And I think there's articles that are important to both. And it just really depends a lot on maybe what someone has experienced and what they know now. I definitely would go to veganhealth.org and look at the recommendations for vegans. If you haven't done that, it could be an eye-opener. Other than that, you know, nothing right off the top of my head. Maybe if you've had a lot of discussions about soy and what vegan hasn't, you might want to read Soy, What's the Harm? The article on soy, I respond to one of the people that get a lot of their information from the Weston Price Foundation. If you go to veganhealth.org and you click on the soy link and then click on response to not soy fast, that's probably the most concise response to all these soy articles that there is.
So what's the Weston Price Foundation?
What's that? What's the Weston Price Foundation? Oh my Lord. They're a group of people that promote, they are anti-soy. They're pretty anti-vegan. You can read a lot about them and their motivations. But if you see an anti-soy article, if you look deeper, it's almost always originates with the Weston Price Foundation in some way. Either people are part of it or they're getting their information from them.
Oh, no
So,
kidding.
yeah.
I've never heard of this thing. Okay, so that is the end of the show. I just wanted to thank Jack one more time for talking to us and answering all of our burning questions about vegan nutrition.
Thank you. I enjoyed this because it was a lot of interesting questions.
Animal Voices is produced from CFBU 103.7 FM in St. Catharines and broadcast since 1996 on CIUT 89.5 FM, the University of Toronto's community radio station. You can also listen to Animal Voices on iTunes Radio under the College University category on Star Choice Channel 826, Rogers Digital Cable Channel 946, or online at CIUT.FM. You can also access our archive. We've got over 380 shows now. It's online at animalvoices.ca. And like I mentioned earlier, you can just press a button and listen. You don't even have to download them anymore. Please spread the word about us on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, all that fun stuff. Thank you to producer Daniel Angernon and the whole Animal Voices team. If you've got comments, questions, or show ideas, please do email us at animalvoices@gmail.com. I'm Erin O'Sullivan. Thanks for listening.